Calling State Affairs Committee to order at 3:21 p.m. And we've got five items on today's agenda, but before we get to those, will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative LeDoux?
Here.
Representative Birch?
Here.
Representative Johnson? Representative Tuck? Representative Josephson, alternate? Representative Knopf? Representative Wolf?
Here.
Representative Kopp, alternate? Chair Price Tompkins?
Here, and with four members present, just one joined by Representative Johnson, at five members, we have a quorum to conduct business. Out of town today and won't be joining us. Five items on today's agenda. Second hearing of SCR 10 from Senator Costello. It's my intent to move that piece of legislation. We also have HB 71, administration bill, first hearing of state affairs this year. And we will hold that bill, but hear that bill. HB 400, this is the second hearing. It's a committee bill relating to fees for fire prevention measures. There's an amendment that will be offered that we have sourced from the department for the committee's consideration. Don't have to take decisive action on it, and we won't move the legislation today. The fourth item on today's agenda is HJR 38 from Representative Kopp. This is the third hearing. It's my intention to take action on the bill today. And finally, HB 310 from Representative Klayman. This is the third hearing, and I intend to take action on that legislation as well. At this time, we'll start with SCR 10 and Senator Costello's staff. Ms. Orm, please come forward in case there are any committee questions or they want to make available to the committee. I should first note that no amendments were submitted by the deadline. I believe it was 10 a.m. this morning. And, of course, we already completed public testimony. Are there any questions from the committee for the sponsor's office? Seeing none, Madam Vice Chair, a motion?
I move SCR 10 version 30-LS0618/U from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note.
Seeing and hearing no objection, SCR 10 moves from committee. Thank you, Ms. Orm. Next item on today's agenda is HB 71 from the administration. Initially relating to no state employee pay increase for 2 years. I'm actually going to take a very quick ease before calling for the Department of Administration. Coming back on the record, and as I at least attempted to explain this Tuesday, there's a committee substitute from working with the administration on this piece of legislation, and actually, I'm going to make sure that I can find it first before making a motion, so take a brief at ease. On the record, now I have the CS. Perhaps what we can do is, before a motion to adopt the CS, Commissioner Designee Riedel, I guess, still. Probably not for long, but please come forward and perhaps synopsize what the committee substitute does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Leslie Riedel. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Administration, and I have Kate Sheehan here with me today. She's the Director of Personnel and Labor Relations, so she'll help you walk through the changes to the bill. But we did work with your office, the administration did, to make changes to this bill and remove some things and add one brand new thing. So that'll be new to you guys today that we'll talk about. But I'll have Kate Sheehan, if you don't mind, walk through the changes.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kate Sheehan. I'm Director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations. And I will walk you through the CS. Section 1 is actually modified from the original bill. It still is language that the governor may waive a portion of his salary. However, what's been removed is the effective dates. In the prior bill, the waiver could be between July 1st, 2017 and July 1st, 2019. Those dates have been taken out, and it's now just a waiver for any time frame. Section 2 is a new section, and basically this this section is here kind of as a vehicle for Section 3. What it's done is it's language that we haven't changed. We did remove a portion of the language that deals with temporary salary schedules are not applied to employees represented by a collective bargaining agreement. We did remove this language, but so you know, it does appear in Section 3. So there's not any changes to statute. We've just kind of moved some things around. Section 3 is a new section, and what this section does is it allows the director of the Division of Personnel to establish a two-week period for biweekly pay for a monthly salary. So currently in statute, it is a monthly salary for employees covered by the pay schedule in statute. How we implement that is semi-monthly, so you're paid on the 15th of the month or the 30th of the month. What we would like to do is have the option of moving to a bi-weekly pay schedule. Essentially, for bi-weekly, you're paid for 2 weeks, so you'd be paid, for instance, every other Friday. So your pay periods are always 75 hours. Under semi-monthly, the pay period hours range from maybe 67 and a half to 90 hours. They split up work weeks. The bi-weekly is consistent hours and is consistent with the work weeks. What most of this is, sections or paragraphs 1 through 5, is the calculations for how that would be done to figure out the hourly rate, to figure out the daily rate, the biweekly rate. So 1 through 5 are those calculations that would need to be followed. And then section or paragraph C of Section 3 is what was removed from Section 2, and that basically states that this does not apply to employees covered by a collective bargaining agreement. Biweekly pay would still need to be bargained with those groups. Section 4 is a new section, and it clarifies that this legislation expressly modifies pay provisions applicable to the governor. And the reason for that is in statute there is some provision that any legislation needs to expressly provide that the pay can change. So that's why that's in there. And then sections 5 through 7 deal with effective dates. Section 5 states that though a governor's ability to waive some of his salary is retroactive to January 1st, 2018. Section 6 just states that sections 1, 4, and 5 of the Act take effect immediately. And then section 7 states that sections 2 and 3 are effective July 1st. 2018.
Thank you, Ms. Sheehan. Any questions from the committee? Representative Ledoux.
Okay, so does Section 1B have anything to do with the deductibility of charitable contributions under federal tax law?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, are you asking, does this make it a charitable donation for him if the governor, he or she, wants to donate it to the, or not take part of the salary? Is that what you're asking?
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, I mean, if the governor doesn't want to take part of his salary, I guess he just writes a check back to the state of Alaska. Why do we need a law that says he writes a check back to the state of Alaska, other than that it might have something to do with the deductibility of charitable donations under federal tax law?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think it is a little bit of an IRS thing, but not so much of a deduction. It's so that the governor doesn't get taxed on money that we're just not paying the governor that piece of the, instead of writing a check back. If he wrote a check back, he got paid, he'd get taxed on it, then he'd be writing it back. So this way, he doesn't get paid at all. So I doubt he could take a charitable donation for it. I'm not an IRS.
Okay, I was just trying to make it clear that this has to do with federal tax law, that the reason for this is federal tax law.
Thank you.
That's what I was trying to figure out.
Yes.
To confirm my understanding, Commissioner Rydell, so if the governor's, what is the governor's salary right now? 140,000.
Yeah, I have it down. I can't remember. A little more. He got a bump a few years ago by the commission.
Yeah, his...
Or let's just say the governor's salary is $164,000, but he only chooses to take $100,000 or $50,000, but he's paying taxes on $164,000, even if he just writes a check back to the state for the marginal $114,000 difference.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. So with this law, he would just take the $50,000 and not have to write a check back to the state. So he wouldn't be paying taxes on something he didn't get.
I think Representative Birch may have a question on the same subject.
Actually, I'm trying to figure out what happened to the bill I actually kind of liked, which had to do with basically pay freezes for non-represented employees. And that's what House Bill 71 was for a whole year last year. Matter of fact, I, through the chair, attempted to make a motion on the floor to actually enact those same cost savings that would have been realized by a freeze. So, as it relates to the governor's salary, it seems like it's a pretty significant change. You had mentioned, Commissioner Designate, that the governor doesn't want to get taxed on his income, so therefore this provision would permit the employer, the people of Alaska, to waive that so he would avoid an income tax on that as income. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, to answer the second question first. It's not so much that he didn't want to pay taxes. I think this, again, we took the dates off so that it could apply to any governor whoever wanted to use this provision. But it did take away the necessity to pay taxes on something you're not going to keep. And, you know, to get a salary and then turn it back, you definitely would have to pay taxes on that. That's not the reason he wanted us to do the bill, is what I'm saying.
Follow up?
I find it extremely ironic that, you know, an administration that has been attempting to impose income taxes on working Alaskans is basically advancing legislation that would permit that very same governor to avoid federal income taxes on his pay. Now, most of us, when we want to make charitable donations, we receive our pay and we turn around and we write a check to our church or charity of choice. And I guess I fail to see why that there's a prohibition on doing that. I mean, if the governor chooses to basically redirect his compensation to a charity of his choice, be it the state of Alaska or anybody else, he's permitted to do that currently. And it seems a little unique to find a situation where we're attempting to modify something that was intended to freeze salaries for state employees that are not represented, and we're kind of turning it around with a substitute to something that's a federal tax avoidance measure for the governor. And I guess I'm kind of perplexed by that.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Birch. For the bill last year also had the information about the governor. The difference of this year's bill is just taking away the dates, or not the information, but the same provision for the governor's pay. The governor's not trying to avoid paying income tax. He's just not wanting to take a full salary. So he'll pay income tax on everything that he gets paid, and or any governor. This would apply to any governor who wants to take advantage of this provision. So he's not trying to avoid any taxes. He just wants to reduce his salary is really what it does. And as far as the the pay freezes for state employees, you're right, that part has been taken out of the bill. So that was in the bill last year, and it is taken out, and actually we should have listed it in our changes. We weren't trying to skip over that. We have taken that out. We have been unable to negotiate that with any of our bargaining units. We've tried. We haven't been very successful. And we just feel like we still wanted to work on this bill for the governor's provision so that if a governor wanted to reduce their salary, that they could. And then the new piece that we added in actually is something that the unions and the employees have been asking us for quite a while, is to go to biweekly pay. It's a much more efficient system for our payroll system to be able to do biweekly instead of the semi-monthly that we do right now. So we thought that this would be an easy way to get that part done so we could have a more efficient payroll system too. So that's why we put it in.
Follow up.
follow-up.
I'm actually good with the, kind of unifying or simplifying the, bi-monthly versus every 2 weeks. I think that makes a lot of sense. I'm deeply disappointed that you didn't, keep the provision on pay freezes. I think that's what the public's looking for. My constituents, talking to them at a town hall just last weekend, they're looking for us to tamp down spending, hold the line on spending, no new hires, and I'm just disappointed that that disappeared out of this. We weren't able to make that happen last year on the floor during budget deliberations. I guess we'll try again this year. But thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think all my questions are answered. Basically, this allows the governor to not take a paycheck but not pay taxes on money he did not receive. Otherwise, he'd get a W-2 at the end of the year for X thousands of dollars.
Through the chair, Mr. Will, he would get it for whatever amount he or she did take in salary. The IRS.
With this current
yes.
bill. Yeah, okay. And the paid every other Friday instead of paid on the 1st and 15th is no big news. And I guess when I read the title of this bill, too, fees, state employee pay increase for 2 years, HB 71, I was expecting that, too. So, and I didn't know. And you sort of alluded to the fact that there was bargaining units that you had to agree with, I guess, on something, right?
Through the chair, Representative. Well, so last year when we had the bill, that was the title for the bill last year, and that was just for non-covereds. We still would have to negotiate it with all of anybody under contract. So we tried. We've been trying, but it's not very popular.
Well, there are a lot of things that are not very popular, and I've had to vote on a few of them too. So
we're trying. We've worked on it.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just curious, is there some reason it's just the governor? I mean, wouldn't we want to just make that so if the governor has that option that anyone could? I mean, especially if you're looking to, you know that a certain amount is going to put you into another pay bracket, you might want to not take some and keep you into a different tax bracket. I mean, there's all kinds of different reasons you might use that for tax planning, I would think.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I was just talking with Kate here while you were asking the question. I don't know that you could do it for every class of employee because of some federal law, but the governor's a little different in state statute than other employees are. We could check with you, with our lawyers, to see if other types of possibly maybe the legislature, the courts, and possibly, the judges possibly, but probably not the line staff.
Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I was going to ask a quick follow-up question based on Representative Johnson. One immediate question that jumps to mind is, I remember when the governor waived a portion or all of the salary. I can't remember what it was. And I could see scenarios in the future where, say, commissioners, not suggesting making any suggestions, for whatever reasons might be interested in it if it was a administration policy that all the commissioners were going to lock hands in a time of austerity or whatever. So I do wonder if it would there would be any logic in potentially adding governor or commissioner or other classification to the bill.
Mr. Chair, we'll check on that and see if there's, like I said, sometimes federal law governs other types of employee, the governor being kind of different.
Mm-hmm.
So not quite an employee. So we'll check and see.
Sounds good. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this reminds me of a proposal, I don't know what form it was, that the governor made, I think before we came down for session, that if something didn't happen by a certain day, he would forego his pay, and I think the legislature would too. So along that line of reasoning, would that mean that if the legislature, let's just say it hypothetically happened, that our pay was suspended after day 120 for failure to pass a budget, would we then, since we're not in this bill, would members of the legislature still be liable for federal tax because we're not included in this sort of give up our pay exemption thing?
Through the chair, Representative, well, I think that was just a per diem, and I don't think you're taxed on per diem right now. So I think that, if I remember correctly, it was just per diem.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Designee Rydell. I don't recall all the crazy bills that were flying around. There was one to cut per diem. there was a couple of them. There's some initiatives, and I thought there was. Yeah, I don't know. But if, let's say, someone did propose to cut pay, unless a provision like this was in place, we would be liable for the federal tax, even though we don't.
Through the chair, Representative. Well, you might actually be thinking possibly of the State Offices Compensation Commission. There was a point where they were considering reducing state. No, that's not what you're talking
about. I recall that. Okay. That's different. Yep.
Okay.
It's no big deal.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may be referring to my bill that is about not having any per diem after 90 days. Nope, not that one. Because I was going to say per diem doesn't get taxed.
Unless you live in Juneau, it gets taxed. But yes, I am aware of that.
Okay. Just checking. I haven't had a hearing on that.
I believe Representative Knopp also has a bill on this subject.
There's a lot of them. I can't keep it up.
Every committee member's got one. Other questions for Department of Administration? Seeing none, may I entertain a motion to adopt the CS?
I move to adopt version 30-GH1018/O as the working draft.
Seeing and hearing no objections, Representative Birch objects to the motion to adopt the CS. Martha, will you please call the roll?
Representative Holt?
Yes.
Representative Ledoux?
Yes.
Representative Birch?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Tuck? Not present. Representative Knopp? Not present. Chair Christ Thompson?
With 3 yeas and 2 nays, the motion to adopt the CS fails. So we will, I believe you need 4 yeses to adopt the motion. Nope, I'm sorry. No, that's just to move it from committee. Excuse me. The motion to adopt the CS passes. Sorry for the scare there. I think we'll hold the bill, research a couple of questions, and bring it back before the committee at a future date. Thank you for making the time. Next on the agenda, HB 400, and this is the second hearing in State Affairs. Ms. Schlinghide, please come forward. And I was absent for the first hearing on this committee bill last week. Maybe just to give the committee the opportunity to pick up any questions that were lingering in the last go-round. Are there any questions from the committee on HB 400 at present? Seeing none, there is an amendment, and this has been drafted in consultation with the Department of Public Safety. Before entertaining a motion, Ms. Schlinghide, could you speak to the amendment?
For the record, this is Kathy Schlinghide, staff to Representative Chris Tompkins. The amendment, labeled Amendment 1, is to establish fines for a violation of fire safety measures. Right now, these offenses are listed as misdemeanors, and in speaking with the Department of Public Safety, they would like to move those out of the misdemeanor section and make them statutorily defined fines. So Section 2 establishes the fines. Section 3 of the amendment allows DPS to issue the citations for those fines, establishes a timeline and procedure for the administration, and Section P of Section 3 is making sure that there is not a double penalty for the same offense, so removes it from the misdemeanor section.
Are there any questions from the committee about Amendment Number 1 on the table? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So these are for fire protection and safety type fines relating to fire code and such?
Through the chair, yes.
I should also note that online is David Tyler, the state fire marshal, as well as Lloyd Nakano, the assistant state fire marshal. And given that this relates to their division, Mr. Tyler, could you put yourself on the record and offer Any other comments on the genesis of this amendment, the value that it might serve?
Mr. Chair, you're partially cut off when they unmuted you. Could you repeat that, please?
Yeah, could you speak to Amendment Number 1, the genesis of the amendment, and the value it would create from your division's perspective?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to. Again, for the record, my name is David Tyler, and I'm a state fire marshal. Currently, we, as mentioned earlier, our only recourse in violations is a warning, a Class B misdemeanor. We have a real reasonable way of approaching this other than straight for the larger gun. With the fines in place, it is a better tool. It's more immediate to get some to get compliant. There's no way there's a parent going to take a misdemeanor charge for a dirty vent hood or for a system that hasn't been certified. There's time for that. This allows us to provide some incentive to stay in compliance without going all the way to the misdemeanor route.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we saw a bill similar to this in another committee, which was basically the penalty that someone incurred on a construction site for violating a certain rule was a misdemeanor, and it was rarely used because it was such a heavy penalty. So they changed it to a fine of a similar type $500 thing, which, of course, makes one think that now this will be used more frequently. So you mentioned a dirty vent, maybe a $500 fine. Could you get an inspection now at a place and someone can go through and find 10 things wrong and be left with a $5,000 fine? Would that be something or five things wrong for a $2,500 fine? Is that the kind of scenario that is likely to pop up?
To the Chair, Representative Wall, no, that is not what I anticipate at all. The $500 is just the maximum that we can charge for a violation. We're doing research to find out what is an appropriate fine, an actual amount, for different things, whether it's a vent hood or whether it's a locked exiting alarm system that's in compliance. Those all have different values to them, the fine. We're going to find the best numbers that we can find that will be too onerous on the businesses because we want them to be able to still repair what needs to be repaired, but at the same time incentivize them to fix it before we get there. We have a safer situation. But I do not expect it to have that large at all, sir.
Okay. Follow up.
Follow up.
Okay, thank you for your response. So this bill started with fees for fire prevention measures. So let's say I'm the owner of a commercial building and I need a fire inspection, and I will pay for that inspection if this bill were to pass. The inspection would happen. Someone would take a note of all the things that I may need to improve or may be wrong. Is that the time that the fines would be assessed, or would there be a period where an assessment is made of the situation? Someone is given time to remedy the situation, and then upon later inspection, or is this, do you have to pay for someone to come out and give you fines, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Through the Chair, Representative Wolf, those are going to be two separate ways let me regroup here. Those will be two separate issues. The fee for the inspection will be billed separately. Our deputies will not be doing that. When we go to the scene or to the building to do the inspection, for the egregious stuff, it's really we will write a citation on this. Our goal is enforcement. Our goal is compliance. And if we go into a building and there's going to be, say, 30 violations, it's easy to find violations in any building. We're not going to go in there and run them broke. We're going to look at the ones that are have an immediate need to be repaired? What's an immediate life safety issue? We're going to work backwards to the ones that are, you know, less immediate. It's our goal to work with people, not to put them out of business.
Follow up?
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I guess I'm just using my own experiences, having a building where people do inspect, whether it's fire marshal or Department of Environmental Conservation and these types of things. And they often will come through, do an inspection, give you a summation of the things that you need to remedy, and give you a certain amount of time, and then you have to reply either in writing or in some other fashion that you've complied with these things, which I think is a great way to get people to comply, because you come out and tell them what everything is wrong, and then you give them, you know, they give you a certain amount of time to get it done, and then you usually have to send them something to say you've done it. And then when they come back again, either scheduled or unscheduled on an annual or whatever basis, you know, I'm sure they'll check to see if those things are actually done. I guess I'm just leery of participating in an inspection process and then, you know, being penalized. I understand what you're saying. You want compliance, and we all want compliance. So I guess I'm just, and I know certain agencies are needing funds, and I just don't want this to be a way to make up for short funding in another area. But, you know, is there a problem besides the misdemeanor issue? Is there a problem you don't have enough of a stick, so to speak, to get people to comply? I mean, when a fire marshal tells me that I got to, you know, do something, I don't mess around. I do it. So I don't know. Are people not following the rules, and then you don't want to slap them with a misdemeanor? Is that what's happening?
Through the chair, Representative Wolf, that's absolutely correct. There are many instances where we're called paper tigers. We have no real bite at the other end unless we go to the misdemeanor route. I could bring one other point up. Before we go out to these, what we're doing in at least 1 month, and we're looking to do it 2 months in advance, we're going to send a letter, a pre-inspection, to the businesses that we're going to go inspect to let them know that we're coming. These are the things that we find generally when we get there. So to give them a time to fix it before we get there. And that just makes life easier for everybody all the way around. They will also know what the fine schedule is for the things that we do find. And it will not be for everything that we could potentially find. We're only going to be shooting for the larger ones. Fire extinguishers not in place, sprinklers or alarm systems not in compliance, egress blockage, emergency lighting, just the large items like that.
Yeah. Okay. Final follow-up, and then I've got a question.
Yeah, I won't take up all your time. Thank you for answering my questions, by the way. I guess I'm just, you said you send out a list of things they need to do, but I'm assuming that means there was a previous inspection. I mean, is the first inspection potentially accompanied by fines, I guess, or is someone given a chance to fix the problem before they get a fine as yet to be of determined value? Is there a sort of a first-time warning, and maybe you haven't done it yet, so you don't know, but you know, you don't know what's wrong with the building till you go there. And if you go there and you see an out-of-date fire extinguisher or an exit light that's not working, or, you know, something like that, is that when you pull out the fine book, or do you say, fix these things and we'll be back later? And I'm sure you don't have a lot of time to do all this stuff either, but can the fines potentially come out on the first visit? I mean, I know you said if it's an egregious violation, but I guess, yeah. And so you go to a place you've never been before, they could be looking at fines without any indication before you get there.
Through the chair, Representative Bull, that is correct. But like I say, there will be a pre-inspection form that goes out so that we can work with them. And it is our goal to work with people and not to just go in there and find them. If it is egregious, if it's bad, yes, we're going to start going down that route right away, but that's not our goal. And sometimes it is difficult to get back out because of the costs.
Right. Okay, so there's a pre-inspection form. That's what I got. Thank you.
And I've got Representative Ledoux and Representative Johnson. We got active microphones here. So two questions that I have. The first is, under current law, how many times have these Class B misdemeanors for failure to comply with occurred over the past five or whatever years? How many Class B misdemeanors are levied per year?
Mr. Chair, I got to start this job in 2007. I took 3 years off, and I'm back for a while, and I have seen none, zero.
Thank you. And my other question is in lines 12 through 14 of the amendment. It notes that each day that the violation or noncompliance continues as a separate, or each day that the violation or noncompliance continues as a separate offense, that presumably means that each day that there isn't compliance, the person who owns the building is subject to another $500 fine. So this can kind of compound. If you've got 2 weeks of noncompliance, you're looking at 14 days of $500 fines, which kind of reminds me of the way APOC fines work. Do I understand the implication correctly?
Mr. Chair, I believe so. That is awfully strong. What we generally would do is wouldn't consider it another violation unless we went back out there and saw that nothing had been done. But I would not see it going every day.
Okay, thank you, Representative Ledoux.
So, I'm just sort of wondering why a distinction is not made in this amendment, or for that matter, the statute that it amends, between somebody who has just been notified that they violated something, and then somebody who fails to comply with an order. I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me that if an inspector goes out and he sees that something's wrong, and you get your violation, which might not even be necessary to be a $500 violation. That seems, well, it says not more than $500, so I guess there's a little bit of leeway there. And then somebody who's been cited for a violation, and you've ordered him to fix whatever the problem is, and he hasn't fixed it. I mean, one seems a lot more culpable than the other does. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, I understand where you're coming from. I just don't know how we would get there, how the language would change to have basically a compounding fine. I'm not sure how we would get there.
Okay, well, that might be something that legislative legal could help us get there. And I realize you might not figure out how to get there, and I might not be able to figure out how to get there, but maybe the good folks in legislative legal can help us to get there. What do you think of the idea, though?
Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, I have no problem with that at all. There are many instances where people just, they know we're going to come in, don't care, because nothing's going to happen. If mine were to get steeper for ignoring us and not taking public safety seriously, I think that would send a better message.
Thank you.
And Representative Johnson, before going to you in the queue, I think what we might do is hold the amendment and work with the department a little bit to potentially see how we can get there with the good folks at Legislative Legal. Representative Ledoux noted any other feedback from the committee and potentially look at a rebooted version of this amendment for the committee's consideration. Representative Johnson, did you still...
Actually.
Go ahead, Representative Ledoux, before we go on to Representative Johnson.
So, and I guess I was also wondering how this works when there's a serious injury or maybe even a death involved. The other day in judiciary, we took up a bill, and I think that bill is going to be on the floor fairly soon, regarding load limits. And a number of people had been very, very seriously hurt or maimed, and, you know, kind of discovered that there really wasn't much punch in our laws relating to load limits, that all it was a violation. And this seems to be, I'm just wondering, I mean, whether someplace in the statute, if you violated the rules and somebody is hurt or killed, it seems to me that there ought to be a fairly stiff penalty, maybe even more than a B misdemeanor, but definitely not simply a violation when there's actually been, because somebody has either not followed the rule in the first place or has failed to comply with an order, and then there's a fire and somebody is hurt or killed, or there's a lot of damage to property. So I'd like to, when we're redoing this amendment, have some consideration for that.
We can do that, Representative Ledoux, and I believe the bill was related to unsecured loads, if I remember
yes.
correctly, and Representative
You're
Propp
right,
is probably
limit,
having flashbacks as a member of Judiciary. noted, and Representative Ledoux, we can accommodate that inquiry. Representative Johnson, do you still have a question on the amendment as presently drafted?
I have an observation, but I will hold that. I mean, I will say that I think if anything should be available to people that want to be law-abiding people and have commercial properties, that fire is one, fire and life safety is one of those things that I think is an essential public service that we, you know, that's why we have government. And, you know, we just went through wanting to waive the, if we get advice on spills, and waive that cost for reimbursement for people that want to get that want to call in and get information on how to fix their spill problem. And for those of us that have commercial buildings and want to make sure that there's proper exiting and all those things, to have that held back by having fees and additional things assessed, I think that's not really where we want to go. So that's my observation on this. I never have thought about the fire marshal as being a paper tiger ever. They show up with their badge, and I think they carry all the weight and enforcement of a law officer, and I certainly feel that way. And then lastly, I would say that giving you the opportunity possibly to go to court, it says not more than $500 a day. Sometimes when you put people's lives in danger, it might be worth a whole lot more than that. And so I think there's some things in there you really need to be evaluated.
Thanks for these comments. Representative Wohl,
I'll be brief.
Final comment. Yes,
thank you,
please.
Mr. Chair.
Go for it.
Along those lines, I never look at the fire marshal as a paper tiger either, and they come in and say to do this, and I do it. However, you know, some people have big buildings, and you never know what they're going to look for on a particular day and how deep they're going to go. And I like the idea of a visit, and maybe I have to pay for the visit now if this bill passes. I got to pay them money to come and look at my building, which I can understand that. But I'd rather get a list of things that need to be fixed, a chance to fix them, and then maybe pay them to come back again. But a 500, I'm just sure that's the extent, per day, per violation, can get really expensive. And, they haven't issued any misdemeanors that this person testifier can recall. How about shutting the person down? You can't open up your business till you fix something. Not a misdemeanor, but a very expensive problem too. So has that happened before in the past, where not a misdemeanor, but if you don't want to go there, we don't have to go there.
Let's hold for now, but I think that's fine. A good question. We can revisit.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tyler, for making yourself available today. Thank you, Ms. Schlinghide. And that, we will hold House Bill 400, a third of five items on today's agenda, which takes us to the penultimate item, HJR 38, from Representative Kopp, the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act of Conveyances Resolution. This is the third hearing in State Affairs. It's my intention to move the bill today. And I should first note that during public testimony last time, a woman in Fairbanks by the name of Bonnie Wolstad attempted to testify but was inadvertently muted in presenting that testimony, and so we've made provision for her to be able to testify today. Unfortunately, I don't see her available, but maybe over the next 15 minutes or so, we can try to make contact to make sure that she has that opportunity. But for now, where I believe we left things last time with the vice chair was the opportunity for Representative Kopp to present comments based on the previous committee hearing.
Thank you, Chair Kreis-Tompkins and Vice Chair Ledoux. Committee members, I very much appreciate a chance to wrap up testimony on House Joint Resolution 38, which I believe represents the singular voice of the legislature to comment on a matter of such important public policy as property rights. The railroad in their testimony said that there was no connection between the 1914 Alaska Railroad Act and the 1875 General Railroad Act. That's a profoundly important statement because it is profoundly wrong. And Mr. Chairman, in 1982, committee members have in front of them a decision of the Interior Board of Land Appeals in which the railroad appealed a selection of state lands on railroad right-of-way, saying that this property had been appropriated, reserved, or otherwise set aside based on what they claimed was a fee simple interest ownership. And so it was not available for state appropriation. The Interior Board of Land Appeals, if you look at the first page of that decision making that, they summarized the railroad's claim that the property was set aside. And if you go to page two, they talked about the Statehood Act that allowed for the selection of these lands along the Fairbanks Meridian, and they commented that the initial BLM decision said the lands were available for appropriation by the state and that they were entirely appropriate for the right-of-way to be acquired as state property. And they said that they made this determination under the Act of March 12, 1914, which is the Alaska Railroad Act. Mr. Chairman, on the bottom of page two of that decision, it said the issue raised by this appeal is whether the land within the right-of-way granted to the Alaska Railroad is occupied, appropriated, and or reserved so as to be exempt from state selection. And they commented that neither counsel seemed to list a case that was really on point. So then this adjudicative board weighed into this, and they said the first case they cited, consideration of the nature of the right-of-way granted by similar statutes, provides guidance. The General Railroad Right-of-Way Act of March 3, 1875, granting a similar right-of-way for railroad across public lands outside Alaska, has been held to convey only an easement and not a fee interest in the land. And then they went back and cited also the Great Northern Railway case of 1942. Two sentences down, says the court held in this case that the reserved right to dispose of the land subject to the right-of-way is inconsistent with the grant of a fee. That's pure ownership, Mr. Chairman, and persuasive that the grant of an easement was the intent of the statute. Mr. Chairman, the court concluded in this case that even under a more restrictive standard, which existed before the General Railroad Act of 1875, they said if we were to look at 1862 and 1864 railroad right-of-way case where there was a limited fee interest, in other words, where railroads did actually own some land, they said even under this standard, the court held it was the intent of Congress that in this case it was the state of Wyoming, would be allowed to take the subsections in its statehood appropriations subject to the right-of-way. So the Interior Board of Land Appeals concluded that under railroad law at this time, they were persuaded that the lands embraced in the appellants, the railroad's right-of-way, should not be considered to be appropriated or reserved at the time of state selection so they could be excluded. And they affirmed the BLM's decision that a right-of-way for railroad shall be reserved in any state selection patent that was at hand in that case. So They directly refer to the General Railroad Act of America in 1875. That is where Congress made a precipitous turn away from land-grant railroads, and they said no more. The only thing from here on out are surface easements, and they are rail, telegraph, and telephone. And that was the easement, Mr. Chair, of the 1914 Alaska Railroad Act. So, Mr. Chairman, House Joint Resolution will have no impact on anything other than the property owned by parties that was unlawfully infringed on in the transfer. Any federal property that was already in a federal interest is not touched by this. We know the federal government did, in fact, own an exclusive use easement in the Denali Park Borough, and they also owned it on native lands where there were contested land claims. But we also know that they never owned it on homestead patent properties, and that's really what is issue here, Mr. Chairman. The railroad also said there is settled law on this matter that railroads either have full simple title or an exclusive use easement. Mr. Chairman, there is no settled law on that. 80% of the railroads in America have a simple easement only, and this is exactly what our Supreme Court said just 3 years ago in Marvin Brandt Revocable Trust versus United States. They said that a railroad right-of-way granted under the General Railroad Right-of-Way Act of 1875 is an easement. Therefore, if a railroad abandons such easement, the landowner regains his unburdened use of the land. So, Mr. Chairman, it is difficult to think of why a limited interest surface easement that the railroad has is insufficient for the Alaska Railroad to safely operate, like most other railroads in America. So whatever the federal government lawfully owned at the time of the transfer, it will not be affected by this House Joint Resolution. This House Joint Resolution simply applies only to rights, titles, and interests that were owned by other parties. It is focused on the homestead patentees and a claim of the railroad to own more than what they actually do. Mr. Chairman, we have asked the railroad to provide us a list of conflicting land claims that the Secretary of Interior has adjudicated to show they went through the due process of taking an exclusive use easement interest on all homestead patent properties. Now, the railroad said they will get back to us because the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act requires that happen. We have no indication to believe that there were any conflicting land claims other than the ones in the Denali Park Borough and where village corporations and other native claimants were competing over areas of land. We do believe the Secretary of Interior made some determinations on that. But homestead patents were never conflicting claims. They were entirely owned by the homesteader. The federal government had completely divested themselves of ownership in that land, and there was no competing claim. House Joint Resolution makes it clear that if you say you have title to the land, you should prove that you have title. And, Mr. Chairman, there is absolutely no lawyer that would ever tell you not to clear your title unless maybe your title is not clear. Mr. Chairman, the one thing every lawyer knows, and every lawyer I've talked to that has reviewed this case, has said the extent of the right-of-way must be determined on a case-by-case, a parcel-by-parcel basis. We have this wonderful system in America called the recording system for titles to keep track of landowners. We can know with certainty now what the interest is in the land going back. So, Mr. Chairman, the bottom line of this resolution is the railroad has made a sweeping claim to an exclusive use easement without doing the work necessary to justify that the federal government had that interest to give to the state in the first place at the time of transfer. And, Mr. Chairman, in ARTA itself, the only place where there's a comment on exclusive use easement is within the Denali National Park and Preserve, and I quote, 45 U.S.C. 120210, Mr. Chairman, this is a definition for rail properties of the Alaska Railroad. The Act says, also includes the exclusive use easement within the Denali National Park and Preserve. Mr. Chairman, there would be no reason to specifically mention the exclusive use easement if it was the de facto easement of the entire right-of-way. Mr. Chairman, three different times the exclusive use easement on federal lands is singled out in those areas only. It makes it very clear it was never the intent of Congress to push that across the homestead patent properties. And our good senator, former Senator Ted Stevens, was quoted out of context when he said that the interest along the right-of-way would be an exclusive use easement. Our Senator Ted Stevens said the federal interest the federal interest, federal lands, where we had the interest to give on those lands, it would be an exclusive use easement. So, Mr. Chairman, obviously there is a disagreement. We have one side that says take it to court. Mr. Chairman, justice is not free. We know that the railroad has asserted that the federal government is bound to defend claims against the right-of-way. There is some dispute of whether or not that, in fact, would involve all claims. But we've also heard the railroad say this doesn't belong here in this body. It belongs in court. Mr. Chairman, that is upsetting that somebody would tell us that we do not have a legitimate purpose as a legislature to weigh in on matters of such serious importance to the state that affects so many landowners, when we know that any individual landowner would be financially destitute taking on a case of this nature. We do have a duty and a responsibility to look in it, to make a claim as a legislature that simply says that we want to disclaim any unlawfully acquired property in this transfer. We're not saying what all that is. We're just saying if you own it, prove it. And if you do, great. But don't expect us to stand idly by and let you make a claim that you can't prove that you have. We are not going to aid and abet in any unlawful taking of property. It's the most important thing Alaskans have is their property rights. And we simply ask that if the Alaska Railroad Corporation makes such a claim, that they are able to prove it, that the federal government had that exclusive use easement at the time of the transfer to give it to them.
And at that time, Representative Kopp, I also want to give you the opportunity to answer any questions that the committee might have.
But thank you, Mr. Chairman,
for that thorough review. Any questions from the committee? And I should note that we did make contact with Bonnie, Ms. Wolstad, and Fairbanks. She's back at work, so she is unable to testify, but appreciates that she's also had the opportunity to submit a written testimony, and her voice has been heard. Are there any comments on this piece of legislation? Representative Birch.
I just speak in support of this resolution. I think it's been a long time coming, as we have discussed through this deliberative process. This issue has been kind of unfinished business for many number of years, and we attempted to resolve some of these issues at a municipal level, and this is, in fact, the appropriate venue and the appropriate body and the appropriate location to take up a resolution of this matter. And I think it's a reasonable approach, it's a sound approach, and it's encourage moving this forward. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative Birch. Other comments from the committee? The motion, Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move HJR 38 version 30-LS1351 /J from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note.
Seeing and hearing no objection, HGA 38 moves from committee. Thank you very much, Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greatly appreciated. Thank you, committee members.
This takes us to our fifth and final item on today's agenda, HB 310, relating to marriage and minimum age for marriage. At this point, we'll take a brief at ease while I confer with the sponsor's office. Going back on the record at this time, I think the will of the sponsor and deference to the will of the committee is to hold HB 310 till a future day. So we will skip over that bill. Next week has been noticed for State Affairs on Tuesday and Thursday. We're going to have hearings on indirect expenditures, overviewing some further possible committee action and statutory changes. On Tuesday, we also have HB 325, the Prisoner Computer Use and Reentry Services Procurement Bill, as you all might remember. And then on Thursday, HB 352 relating to voter registration and permanent fund dividend voter application registration. So that's a bill from the Division of Elections. And at this time, at 4:23 p.m., we are adjourned.